well-known and well-regarded figure within the Boston area entrepreneurial community. His clients include Acme Packet, Enernoc, Carbonite, Bright Cove, TripAdvisor, Casual Mail Retail Group, Cambridge Soundworks, Abiomed, and Skillsoft. As a managing partner of Ernst & Young's Boston office and the New England market sector, life sciences, right?
No, not life sciences. Scary. That was scary.
What was it?
The whole market.
Oh, the whole market.
Yeah.
Okay. The whole market leader. From 2012 to 2017, he led double-digit market growth and revenue growth. During his tenure, EY Life Science team achieved number one status in the Boston IPO market. George was responsible for nearly 2,000 professionals during a period of minor corporate culture change. Major culture change, because I worked there. I did work there, too. That was major corporate change. He was part of the EY leadership team that helped the firm be recognized by Fortune magazine as one of the best places to work in the United States. He understands how to manage during times of change, both good change and bad change. As a partner in Arthur Andersen, he led the internet practice and specialized in the Boston venture capital and private equity market worlds. He helped stabilize clients and employees during Arthur Andersen's demise. And of course, when George left Arthur Andersen and joined Ernst & Young, all of his clients went with him. And as expected.
They were crazy.
No. George is a board member for EverQuote, a NASDAQ-listed company, and senior advisor to Avault, a Boston-based private equity-focused family office. And they are investing in lots of startup companies here in the Boston area. He's also working with a number of emerging growth companies in a board and or advisory capacity. George's previous board roles include trustees for the Yawkey Foundation, and they give away millions in the Boston area each year, Massachusetts Society of CPAs, and the United Way of Massachusetts Bay. And George received his Bachelor of Science in Accounting from Boston College. So
thanks, Mary. Boston College before Doug Flutie, as I like to caution people.
One thing is truth in advertising. So the talk tonight is the CFO to the audit committee. Get rid of that CPA partner. That's what the case is about.
So apologize
to
the HR
people. False advertising for anybody came for
an
HR.
A little misc, but I think you'll find this intriguing. But please give it out.
We're going to give out the case, and you're going to read it for a few minutes, and then George will begin.
Yeah, and then we'll have a little dialogue. This is based on a factual circumstance. So if you can put yourself in the role of the audit committee chair and or a board member, because I do think responsibility for these types of situations falls upon all board members, but a public company scenario. So for those intrigued by the fun and games that can happen there, but I appreciate the opening comments. I can take no credit for them because Larry was the one who helped me with my resume and my CV when I left EY when I retired last year. So all those words, I kept saying to him, Larry, come on, why are you saying all this great stuff about me? But it's the power of the persuasion. I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you and talk. So
great.
Let everyone take a few minutes, and then you can have some questions. One thing you can't ask until the end is, what's the name of the company?
Or how did it work out?
I knew if one person was here tonight, she would have known it. And I think you know who would have been left.
Oh.
And it wasn't the company she was involved with.
Right.
Everybody finished?
I just want to start a dialogue for the non-financial people, just to put some perspective that might help. Just with public companies, particularly the auditors are hired and engaged by the audit committee. They work for the audit committee, but they work with management. So this triangle, audit committee, auditors, management, hopefully can give you some perspective of uniqueness of the relationship that has to be. Another thing I'd put just as a sideline, and I do want to give Larry credit because your two edits to the case study were the first lines. Your first instinct is to review your D&O insurance policy. Yeah, second is to not think about it. So put that in frame because this is very common and can happen. So so I throw it out just, and again, for those who didn't finish the case or still have some thoughts, we could any initial questions, and then I could try to frame the discussion a little bit in a couple areas. Do you think this is unusual?
No.
Okay.
Why have there been 3 CFOs?
6 years.
Fred, great question. Why? The company, and again, with most growth companies, they were constantly underinvesting in the finance area. So they never had the right people doing the right things. And the CFOs, actually 2 of the 3 were very, very competent, got incredibly frustrated and just left. And so you had a situation where a company, particularly when they started slowing their growth, you know, the last thing you can do is add more infrastructure, right? You got to invest in sales and marketing and technology to be on the leading edge. But with the increased compliance of the PCOB, you know, to deal with as a public company, just put more and more in strength. And so I think the comment in there, their goal every year was just to be good enough. So different Alex and Sherwin-Williams, you know, a great company that has infrastructure. A company like this that really grew like a rocket ship just always was 9 yards behind.
But also it seems that, so there were some issues of like revenue.
Yes.
Very good. So that was very much, I think maybe that's what caused the issue.
Yeah.
Allowing, if not manipulation of business, that's what kind of, maybe essence of it was not recognizable.
No, Alex, great point. You know, this is a company that most public companies, unfortunately, live by. And I heard today, President Trump, I think 2 weeks ago, petitioned the SEC to consider 6-month reporting. Mindy, you may have heard this, similar to what the UK did, and then the UK went to quarterly, now they're back to biennial, because of this whole perception of the pressure that companies are under to meet quarterly goals.
Year over year, can you quarter over quarter, that's what we do.
Yeah.
And
this company was clearly, they were a high flyer, a screamer, and keeping up with that pace. And I think if it didn't come through, they were a very complicated company. They were not just selling one product through to one channel. They were selling multiple different high-end, big value systems to low-end point of sale through retail. So you really had different channels, very complicated, and you didn't have the infrastructure and system to kind of keep a leash on it.
I assume the CFO is not a board member.
Yeah, not a board member, yeah. And right now, Warren, that's pretty much, the old days you could get away with that. CEOs generally, 99% are, but more often than not, more and more of the larger companies are splitting the chairman, non-executive chairman, and the CEO roles, but CFOs are not. Yeah, Jim.
I'm surprised that they changed the CPA firm before they changed the CFO. I mean, there are all kinds of red flags here. That, you know, they've got operational issues in their accounting department, and they just don't have the right systems in place. It's like you get a new CFO first.
Yeah.
Or I don't understand why they did it in the opposite way.
Yeah. So they changed from one of the big four to another one back in 07, 08, because that big four firm had actually communicated pretty harshly to the audit committee that the company did not have sufficient controls in place, had material weaknesses, things that should have been red flags. And unfortunately, to get through that process, they were running up a lot of fees. So the management at that time positioned it as, hey, our fees are out of control, we need to get a different answer, not let's deal with the problem. And that's one perspective.
You just said magic words, we need a different answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this conversation starts with the CEO and what he says to the CFO. And the succession of CFOs, I don't think that's an unconnected set of observations. He has a set of CFOs. He's got to be looking for revenue growth. He's desperate for
it. Make it happen.
And he's trying to squeeze it out of wherever he can get it. And I think he's pushing the envelope further than it should be. And there's his first CPA firm told him that, so he fired them. And then his probably succession of CFOs said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He wants the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And this board sat through all these various discussions.
Board basically.
You're talking about hiring the accountant applicant, right? You give them a pile of papers and tell me what my net income should be, and the people work and work, give them numbers, and so we'll get back to you. And finally, somebody said, well, what do you want it to be? This is your hire. Can you start tomorrow? regarding the CPA firm, that was some time ago, but the problem is that they've rolled off one
the next
partner
yep.
and now have a new one as a different perspective. Then they brought on a new CFO.
Yep.
And at the very least, it sounds like there may be a personality or chemistry difficulty between the two. Mm-hmm. But then fundamentally there, it goes back to a little bit, why did the earlier CFOs leave? Frustration, and then that leads to your comment about the CEO is how much autonomy does the CFO really have in terms of these things? And then it's compounded by the fact you've got a company that is now suddenly really worried about revenue reporting, quarterly, whatever, because the growth is so slow, and now these changes are actually probably going to show a reduction in revenues, which is not good for share prices.
No. And eventually, the company eventually did have to restate stock when 80% down.
So some of the things that are going on here, we clearly have a difference in accounting philosophy. We don't have enough information to know who is right, and whether it's an honest difference of opinion, somebody's being too conservative, too aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But also at the heart of it, I think there's a CEO issue here that needs to be examined. As you point out, I think these days CFOs truly are more partners with CFOs with CEOs than maybe in the past. And so maybe there's something going on there that strategically is involved as well. But at the heart is the revenue recognition here, which is, sounds like it's a problem that needs to be fixed.
Yep.
And you just have to bite the bullet.
And do it. Yeah, Joe.
The other clue on the revenue recognition part is the fact that the receivables are aging out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just an accounting issue. They're not collecting the
this
cash.
Is the
So that kind of says, okay, are you pushing the revenue? And maybe it's not real because you can't convert it into cash.
Mm-hmm.
How strong was the audit committee?
They met the qualifications of financial experts.
Right.
but Mary, how strong was the... and Mary, it's a great question because, it gets down to the basic question as a board, and you guys have hit a couple of the issues, Richard. The tone at the top set by the CEO. He's burned through a number of CFOs. Fundamentally, there's something there. And how engaged are you going to be to confront and force change at that level? And this board didn't.
But if you have an audit committee that's engaged and knowledgeable, when you're changing auditors, the next firm has to come in and do their due diligence and figure out why is the other firm leaving. and yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a requirement to do that.
Yeah.
And so as an audit committee, you would expect that they would say, we want to know what you've learned. If there's something we don't know, if we're engaging you, why is it that this firm doesn't, we are changing, but what have you learned? And then to work with that new audit firm. I mean, the audit firm is their guides them. And they are required, it's a public company, to work with the audit firm. They're working as a board member, but making sure that what is being seen by the audit firm is being dealt with by the audit committee. And it seems like maybe the
communication, the triangle ain't working.
We're more influenced by.
I see one of these, though, when you have a sentence about the CFO doesn't trust the audit partner, and then the audit partner is going to exec session saying, hey, I think we should, do something, too. It's like this. Forget the CEO point. Do agree with you. I think the CEO, we got a CEO problem, not a CFO problem.
Yeah.
Well, it's also the new audit firm went in and said, hello, what have we got here? I think it's a mess with stock options, not just this.
Oh, yeah.
And that this company's not really acting like a public company and not doing the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And so this audit part is probably saying, why did we take this and go?
We had many discussions, Mindy. I can share it on that.
You can imagine that with that kind of turnover in the CFO office there, maybe the first two that left out of frustration, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more why, but one possibility might be that they wanted to do things right, and the CEO, under the pressure of slowing growth rates, said, look, we need to sort of keep things looking as good as possible here, and then they ran into a conflict and got tired of fighting that battle, and the new CFO may be somebody that's a little bit more compliant, and then that's where they're running into problems with the audit partner who still has the idea that, okay, this is the way things should be done here, and that's where the conflict is. Once the CFO said, well, change this person out, get somebody else. But,
So it's apart from the, I'm a business, maybe technology guy, so apart from the, you know, audit accounting, how it's managed, right, by these functions, isn't it the essence of the issue is that it's a multi-generation business, so they've committed to certain growth projections. They are calling some of these product upgrades extended warranties that allow you to defer. So they essentially they've been not inflating, but
they
overly happened. Optimistic about growth of revenues. CEO and maybe the board could have not understood, right? Because it's valuation, it's stock, it's everything else. And I think it was simply, I think they were getting closer to the cliff, right? When the realization of the right accounting comes in, not only apparent, but how it was done, it'll tank. That's how it happened.
Yeah, no, that's it. You're right on. Let me mic it and I'll come back.
My take on this, George, is that I'm startled by a company that hits an inflection point in its growth 7 or 8 years after its IPO. A few years later, they're transitioning from the best-in-class competitor in the industry to marginally profitable. And I'm wondering if so many of the issues we're focused on at the moment, which is the circumstance of the case, is really just arguing over arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, and that we really have a far more profound problem, which is why the CFO is struggling to look for sources of revenue recognition. Guys, what's happening up in the wheelhouse?
No. You both of you were hitting on. I mean, you've got a business that was going like this that starts to flatline. And, you know, but you have to meet Wall Street expectations, your quarterly company, your access to capital. Unfortunately, the company tried to find buyers for the business, which ultimately sometimes is the best solution when you know you're going to kind of hit that wall. And unfortunately, they were just kind of a unique beast in the complexities around it. There was no one that it was really a perfect fit. So, Richard, you hit on it, and a number of you, but I mean, one of the things that becomes a challenge, I think, as a board is, if you're in that seat, how do you change the tone within the organization? You've changed your CFOs 3-4 times. You've changed audit firms. You've changed partners. But there's a fundamental issue. You've got a business that's struggling. You're trying to put lipstick on it, make it look much better. And all it's doing is putting pressure throughout the rest of the organization. Everyone's sloppy. And, the, you know, Mindy, as you said, stock-based comp, every inventory reserves, every account wasn't properly reconciled. And this was $500 million, $700 million company. We're not talking about a, you know, overnight development stage or early stage. This is a company, and they had people. But there was the tone. How do you deal with that as a board? Yeah, Larry?
This is a question, it's not a comment.
Okay.
For a company that's a public company, $700 million in sales, is there an ISS ranking rating for the board as a whole and then for the audit committee as, as a whole? Would that give me help give me a sense about, would that information like that be of help?
I think so,
yeah.
But I don't think it was available back then. You know, it wasn't available back then.
Okay.
I mean, I think all those agencies are starting to do more and more. They're doing it on the bigger companies. I mean, this is a mid-cap, you know, company, so it didn't hit that radar. Anybody else have comments?
Was this a client?
Full disclosure? Yeah, it wasn't mine, but I was the managing partner, so I live this.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that a client relationship would have provided an opportunity to reflect on some of the issues that are being raised here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be surprised if senior management and the board wouldn't be very pleased to hear the candid mm-hmm. assessments of Arthur Young.
Mm-hmm.
Because those reflections should have mirrored the issues we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you've got the problems is you don't have any way to grow revenue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how
you got a business issue. Yeah, you really
you can't get the right people here
mm-hmm.
in the financial.
Can't attract great
you
people.
You can't keep changing auditors because mm-hmm. Wall Street doesn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
if that, even if you can make it fly, Wall mm-hmm. Street is not happy. And God knows what else you might have been reflecting back to senior management
mm-hmm.
in terms of the more fundamental issue of the inflection point and the, of the business going from like this to
mm-hmm.
flat or mature or down.
Mm-hmm.
And or why it wasn't available for sale.
Mm-hmm.
You can always slice it up and sell off the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is the board was valuing this thing as the current stock price, looking for a multiple of that to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Anybody looks at it is going to say, what are you, crazy? I mean, they see what's happening. So I'm surprised to hear they were a client because it sounds like a fairly dysfunctional relationship between the board, the audit committee, and the auditors.
And management.
Over an extended period.
Yep.
Not just an issue comes up. Multiple turnover in the CFO position, changing the audit firm, issues that clearly suggested the problems in revenue recognition, which are indicative, not causal, indicative of more fundamental issues in the nature of the business model.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they might have not known that if the accounting was not done right, so they didn't.
But you have to believe if they're changing the audit firm, you know, was saying, we got problems here.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer of the firm was, okay, we'll change the audit firm.
It also, I mean, one thing that you pointed out was that they had lost their founders and investors, and they were now with people who really had no deep experience.
Mindy, that.
So it's not like people on the board could say, look, I know this industry, and this is mm-hmm. what you should be
yeah.
doing. If they were sort of like floating out there without the right
mm-hmm.
Even on the board side.
Yeah. How strong was the board chair?
On paper, very strong, but relative to engagement and holding the executive team accountable, poor. So,
the audit chair.
Similar. The two of them, so you would meet, which again, I was not the signing partner, but given that I had responsibility for all the.
I'm guessing you're not an executive chairman either.
No. And what would happen is we'd spend 2-3 hours going through all challenges. And to your point, you would think there'd be, and it was basically a roadmap, but you'd have to make the investment to, one, set the proper tone and fill in the infrastructure. And they go back to the CEO, and, you know, 6 months later, we back around the table again and say, the issues are still here. Now, as the outside auditor, you could throw bodies at it and kill it. I mean, you just kept auditing, and unfortunately, as I even said to the board, I said, it's an embarrassment. Would you have to pay us to audit you? Because if you put it on any delta, any competitors, audit fees, as a percentage of revenues, all the metrics that people kind of use, it was 4x. And I said, so I, you know, you want to keep paying us all this money, we're going to do a lot of work because we got to manage the risk. You know, you've got people that don't understand revenue recognition. You don't have people that are doing stock-based, you know, different things. We're going to fix it. So, you know, it gets down, and interesting, you've all brought up some great points, is, you know, as a director, you know, you don't want to cross that line taking full responsibility for things, but are you willing to step up and hold the management team accountable? Now, there's issues I could share on with the audit partner, too. It's someone, Mary, you knew for many years ago. And he style issue and whatever. I mean, he could drive, you know, he could drive you to drink, but that's a separate issue. But still, in terms of the responsibility you have as a board and also in each of the parties, are you willing to be accountable?
I mean, for that individual board member, I guess the chain of communication would be to the chairman of the chair of the audit committee. And then, if that's not satisfactory, the chair of the board.
Yep.
Because really, you really want to get to the CEO. Ideally, you probably have to talk directly with the CEO. Mm-hmm. But you've got to make sure you manage the overall board governance.
But John, that's the flow, and then meeting with the CEO, which I did twice a year, and said, you know, you're not making progress on this.
So how many people are on the board?
There were nine.
Nine. So
each making about $125,000 a year.
That seems like small for nine for almost $1 billion. No?
I don't know.
I think that's 11.
Seven.
Yeah.
So you've got two out of nine.
It's even a lot.
May or may not be helpful to you.
Yep.
And the CEO is on the board as well, so that's three out of nine. You need to get to the CEO. So as an alternative, is there a way to sort of marshal some coalition of the non-audit committee board members and say, look, this company is sailing in the wrong direction in a number strategically, and it's also running some serious risks in terms of its accounting treatments here, which will, at the very least, have an evaluation impact, or potentially could have some real serious D&O legal impacts for us. And so, I guess the first recommendation might be audit chair, board chair, and if not, that's not working, then you've got to figure out some other way to not take charge, but also mount sort of a
John, you have a great point.
Does this board meet in executive session without management?
Yes. Yeah. And those would usually go on for at least an hour each quarter, which is fairly long.
Well, for a vehicle, at least to start a discussion.
Yep.
Because it would be very hard to have a discussion like this out of the blue with the CEO, because you're basically telling me he's doing a lousy job.
But why boards? Isn't it the operational accountability to clean up accounting practices and staff? So it's really CEO, right? So boards, particularly this is an advisory body, they can flag.
I don't think they're advisory.
They're fiduciary. Yeah, they're fiduciary. They're charged with governance, and this is their responsibility.
Okay, so Alex, accountability is on the board.
They're there to oversee and say everything is as it should be. Well, they can be sued, and they should be sued.
I see.
And that liability has been growing over the years. It's increased. There's been much more focus post Enron and everyone else about board accountability.
It's funny you should mention Enron, because I was on the board of a Fortune 500 company just at the time that the Enron thing went down, and funnily enough, we were dealing with an issue that had to do with derivatives and how you accounted for them. And we got this presentation from the audit committee, and you brought in the partner from the audit firm. And I got to say, I didn't understand a word of it. And
you're a smart person.
I wasn't at that time. We had a conversation at the board in which we were able to ask ourselves, what is it that we would have done differently had we been in the boardroom? I don't know. Because actually, some of the things were pretty similar. And it was kind of a shit moment. I didn't have a good answer to that question. Other than to really get to know about what a derivative means and how it works and do the diligence. And I think that, there are some substantive issues in this case that have to do with the complexities of accounting. And maybe the board doesn't understand that. And certainly one place to start would be some due diligence around that.
In my role as timekeeper, we have about 10 minutes. So I'd like you to think about what you should do as a board, and then George will tell you what the outcome was. But if you would take some suggestions as a board to make a decision, what are you going to do with this situation?
I think the first point is you need to understand, the board needs to understand the kind of the range of the accounting issues. Mm-hmm. You've got two people that are telling you different stories, and as you point out, maybe there isn't sufficient technical expertise within the board itself to be able to make a determination as to which one is more acceptable or not. And that's setting aside all the business strategy issues here. We've just got to try to fix the accounting issues. And maybe that means bringing in the auditing firm as subject matter experts to try to explain the differences in those accounting treatments, and what are the circumstances in which one is acceptable or not, what are the soft issues in that, because there is a lot of latitude there, and the board needs to be able to nail down exactly where do these issues lie, which one is out of bounds, and which one might be more in bounds. Mm-hmm. And they try to really just understand that.
Mm-hmm. I think the board has to really understand their role better. I mean, mm-hmm. I think you really need to bring in a good governing council to really talk to them about what the issues are and what's been going on with the audit committee, and that their fannies are on the line and they've got to really take some responsibility or not be involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it sounds like it's at that serious mm-hmm. point where yep. there's got to be an understanding if they need to bring in other directors, then they need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If they could get anybody to yep. this situation.
I think, and I don't know if it's possible, but somehow I'd like to have two rooms, have the CFO here, have the CEO there, and have two executive sessions with each of them separately,
mm-hmm.
and just try to understand what's going on
mm-hmm.
there. Whether it's a tone at the top issue, someone's trying to plead, I don't know what it mm-hmm. is. I wouldn't want them in the same room testifying.
Yeah.
I know, exactly.
I agree with Mindy. I don't think they, as a board, understand totally what their role is. They are a board of a public company.
Mm-hmm.
They do have shareholder responsibility and their fiduciary responsibility. Mm-hmm. And if they don't understand everything about what's going on behind the scenes, then they need to figure out among the board who can get that understanding and knowledge. And then how are they going to figure out how to deal with this problem?
Mm-hmm.
But right now it doesn't sound like they have a firm grip on the whole financial. Yes, mm-hmm. we keep on having these restatements and mm-hmm. auditors and everything like that, but it doesn't sound like someone on the board understands that. So I agree that they need to understand their role better and then get more hands-on.
There's a comment that is resonating over here, because I was sitting here wondering, could a board recommend the board needs to be changed? Because
some stuff
the committee recommended to the CEO that a new CFO might be needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at that thinking, where are these guys coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody turned on the 5-watt bulb overhead yet?
Yeah. Nope. They didn't. Like Jim, yeah.
I'm left wondering whether or not we have enough time. Not the time that you're talking about, but does this company have enough time to fix this problem?
Mm.
I'm not sure they do. I don't think the runway is there. You've got so much dysfunction at the auditing level, the board level, and within the management. It's almost an impossible thing to turn around unless.
So what do you do?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Can board ask for a day of operations review?
Can they answer what else?
Ask for operations review, right?
Yep.
Review of the each business unit.
Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Oh, they
revenue,
did that, yeah.
Technology, investment, operations,
mm-hmm.
CapEx, and I think they would have greatly increased comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it sounds like.
For those experienced people, right? If they operated the
They
level
were very
level,
experienced, but
boss.
They didn't understand this industry. It's like what Richard alluded to. And so they had quarterly board meetings that went on for a full day where they were briefed on the business, the operations, investments, sales and marketing channel, all. But did they understand enough of it?
Right, and then they implement, right? So you mm-hmm. can do all that you're talking about, and I agree with it, but it doesn't sound like that board had the capability of implementing any of the
mm-hmm.
recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, I kind of seconding what you guys had said. And that is, within the audit committee, they have to recognize there's a trend now.
Mm-hmm.
This is not just a one-off event.
Mm-hmm.
They've lost a number of CFOs. There must have been issues that have come from the prior auditor that went up to the audit committee.
Mm-hmm.
The audit committee would have seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it didn't bounce over the materiality, but it was probably pretty close. And my guess is they probably had a number of offsetting issues, and they probably got lucky on a few where there was an offset.
They got very lucky.
But what it could have been was much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're in a situation where they've changed auditors. Well, they've changed partners at the auditors,
mm-hmm.
and they've got a trend.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got my CFO at heads with my auditor. There's something else going on, and
mm-hmm.
they've got to dig into it to get mm-hmm. to the bottom of it. And it comes back to that fiduciary responsibility. Mm-hmm. Either they are on that audit committee and they're going to do their job, or they need to get off.
Mm-hmm.
And they need a self-awareness.
But it's not just the audit committee.
Yep.
I mean, I would say
it's a board issue.
Board.
Yep.
Board.
It's a full board.
The whole board's responsible.
Yes, the delegates.
I'm just. I'm reminded. I haven't seen Richard Herman.
Right.
In,
absolutely. You're there for 6 years. What the hell?
Yeah.
I haven't seen Richard in several years, but many years ago we did a search for public company board, and I brought Richard onto that technology board as well as three other people onto the board. In very short order, they were all gone. And the CEO was very proud of that. And he told me, he says, you know, now we have a board only of investors. Think about that just for a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, for a lot of technology companies, you know, like fintech, mm-hmm. you can be an investor. And you may not know a thing about mm-hmm. fintech mm-hmm. or about robotics. And I think the person who just said, you know, is there someone on the board who really understands this industry? I see a lot of that in technology, mm-hmm. including private equity mm-hmm. boards, where because I know how to read an Excel spreadsheet, mm-hmm. I'm an expert in this industry, and they're not. So one recommendation I would certainly make is that the board needs to look at itself and have at least one person who really understands
mm-hmm.
the dynamics of this industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. They think they're great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have to self-evaluate themselves.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Larry, you're 100% right.
And the other thing that I keep on going back, the 7 years when they went public.
Yeah.
At that point, a lot of companies might go public, but they don't realize, and they need to realize at that time, how life will change. As a company, and how you have to have these things set up and structure in place. It can't take 2 to 3 years after,
mm-hmm.
because when things start to change, the margins, you don't even have your reporting systems in place.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time you go public, that's the time to really assess, where do we stand? Can we do this? Is the board capable
mm-hmm.
of it?
Well, it's changing here rapidly for the technologies mm-hmm. that this business is based on. And you can't have a board that's going to be knowledgeable at that level of granularity, but they certainly have to recognize when they need particular skills to do the kind of thing that Alex is talking about, so that when you do an operational review, the right people are looking at the right things.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked about board refreshment, didn't you?
Yeah. So I'll tell you how this played out. So a couple other points that weren't in the case. So I think Warren, you asked about the audit firm. You know, why would they be involved with a company like this if they had problems? You know, each of the firms goes through an annual review of clients from a risk standpoint. How risky are they? From a management standpoint, financial risk, you know, complications, all that, and puts a grade on them. This company was rated highest in New England over a number of years. So there was an understanding that it was a high-risk situation. Their audit fees were 4x what they should have been because the environment wasn't there. The discussions, quarterly executive sessions that went on for at least 1 hour with the audit committee, and then once a year with the full board, without management, talking about the issues, whatever. And there wasn't a fight back from there was kind of an acceptance, and I think a couple of you raised. Unfortunately, the members of the board didn't understand the industry. They were very smart. The accounting issues weren't as complicated as derivatives or others, but even when expressed, but it was their ability to take on the CEO to get the heart-to-heart with him of saying, look, it, you know, things are really a problem here. So as this process came, the company announced that they had to do a restatement. The stock went down 90%. Mm-hmm. 90%, yep.
How far past the date of this case did the restatement take place?
The restatement, it took them about a year to get it, because...
So fairly short.
Yeah, I mean, some take faster. This one was long. It cost them multi-millions to get it. But the interesting thing, and the question was, to open this case, you know, as a board, management, particularly the new CFO, who's at odds with the partner, doesn't want to work with him, wants a new partner. And so the board, and they reached out to me. Again, I was the managing partner responsible for who did what, when, where. And given the profile of the company and where they were, I was told we're not going to change partners. You know, I will be much more spending probably a quarter of my time up there. I'll spend more babysitting the CFO, make sure everyone plays well and everyone gets along. But you've got fundamental issues. And we need to get through this process. We can figure out at the end whether we get divorced. You go one way, we go the other. We want to help you get through. But I'm not going to fire someone and take them off the account who's giving you, you may not like the message, but it's the message. And so, as I say, my favorite phone call, they called me on New Year's Eve, after 3 weeks after that, and they said, board's decided to disengage you as a firm. I said, thank you very much. I know my team, which was planning on working 24/7 for the next 6 months, were now clicking their heels, booking their ski vacations, and getting all excited. And I said, more power to you. Good luck. It took me a year to get through the restatement. The stock bounced back some. That CFO left a year later. And the company continues to operate, and it's a very troubled company. And all the symptoms, the business issues, are still there. Recently, the CEO had to step down as part of the Me Too phenomenon. So you can appreciate that.
I think I know the company.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. So I'm not going to say anything more.
What accounting firm took over?
Well, actually, ironically, it was one of the other big four. And then 1 year later, they fired them and moved down to a national firm.
My gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and the board has basically stayed pretty intact. I think one or two have come off. But,
So over 5 years, they had three different audit firms?
No, they changed partners on one. They 07 moved to EY, 12, 13 moved to another firm, and then went to 15, they went to a national firm. So,
George, could you just, for a point of information, explain or give us some color on how customer deliverables or customer obligations could be key in the timing of revenue recognition?
Sure, Mike, and again, not to bore the financial people or the non-financial, but generally when you deliver more than one element in an arrangement, so you're delivering a hardware, you're delivering a software license, you're delivering services, you're delivering a maintenance arrangement, you know, you're delivering a menu to a customer who's getting it. The question is how do you bifurcate the revenue between each of those items? Because some may be delivered up front, some may be delivered over time, and so it can materially affect
one price for everything.
Generally, yes, and there may be option price. Rob's smiling. It can, and this company, particularly when they were dealing with some of the large contracts, they were very complicated contracts, not easy. It five or six different deliverables, but depending upon the not only the value you put on them, but in certain circumstances, upgrades, which particularly in a technology world, which that's where my hair went gray and maybe some others around here, the difference between an upgrade, which is, hey, we promise to keep you current and all that, well, that's got value. So you may pay me X, never pay me anything more, and that's generally covered under maintenance, so you would defer some of that upfront revenue and recognize it when you deliver that upgrade. But if it's not being defined as an upgrade and it's being defined as just add some warranty items, it's bug fixes that aren't big deals, under the accounting rules, that's not treated as a separate deliverable. So you're unable to take revenue all up front. So, I mean, it's for anyone involved with companies right now, the biggest thing going on is revenue recognition, for better or worse, right? Which is, there's a new standard out, which is to try to, once you identify all of them, put values. Back at this point in time, this company originally was more, again, I think everyone thought they were a hardware company, right? When you think about Massachusetts with DEC Data General, but it was software that was really the value. And when you dealt in those complicated things, you could upfront more revenue, which ultimately, for a company not growing, it's going to catch up with you over time. Did that help? Okay.
Thank you, George. I think it's a great conversation. Any last questions, or are we good?
Were there any lawsuits associated
yes.
with that?
Class actions, left yeah. and right, Jim. And that's why when Larry wrote the line there, I remember, I was like, if I was on this board, like, and you got your auditor telling you that, you know, you got problems, and you're going to restate and whatever, and it's hard to bail ship in that, but you've got an environment with the management team just seeing the world very different. What do you do? You know, do you fight the fight? Do you try to get a coalition? There was one board member that did try to kind of get a couple of the others to kind of get some, I'll call it reconciliation to reality. But, you know, they were 3 out of 9, 6. They got a business problem. And you're telling me you want to spend more money in G&A on accounting and finance when, you know, Mike, I think you said the chairs on the Titanic are sinking. Why are we going to spend time for maybe out of business? You know, you got an obligation. The company's market cap was still $1.2 billion. Hmm. And when the start, and then with the restatement, it went down to 200, 250 or something, and then it went back up to 450, 500. So, but, well, thank you for listening. But
thank
really
you.
Good conversation. But no, thank you. It was great connecting.
Next month, we will have another Seat at the Table program. Luann Muir was a VP of HR at Fidelity, worked with Ned Johnson on the succession and transition issues at the Johnson family at Fidelity. Mm-hmm. She's going to present a case of a much smaller professional service company where there's a dominant CEO and the board's insisting on leadership succession planning, and he's coming up with a plan, and you've got to review it. So Luann's going to be talking about leadership succession. That might be interesting for you.
Yeah.
Hope great to see you next
great.
Month.
Great seeing you. Good seeing you
again. Good story. Oh, well, that was interesting.
Sure. Yeah,
it was interesting.
That's great.
We always had private meeting with the interview.